Welcome back, folks. Good to have you with us here on the Mark Steiner Show on your source for cool jazz and more, WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. We are going to spend the rest of this hour, I should say, talking about President Donald Trump's latest executive order on immigration bans and the immigration orders. And we are joined by phone. John Malcolm is director of the Edwin Meese III Center for Legal and Judicial Studies, the Ed Gilbertson and Sherry Lindbergh Gilbertson Senior Legal Fellow at the Heritage Foundation. John, good to have you with us.
Good to be with you.
Shireen Shabaya is in the studio. Shireen is a civil rights attorney, one of the organizers of the Dulles Justice Coalition created in response to the recent travel bans, and former director of the ACLU Maryland, the ACLU of Maryland's Immigration Rights Program. Good to have you in the studio, Shireen.
Good to be back, Mark.
And you all can join us here at 410-319-8888. Write to us here at talk@steinershow.org. By email, you can tweet us at Mark Steiner or log on to our Facebook pages. Looking forward to being part of this conversation. So let's begin. I mean, so the original ban that took place was tested in court, pushed back by the courts. So the White House had to come up with a new order, a new tactic and strategy. And so this one leaves Iraq out of the mix. And some people have argued that this particular order, the way it's written, which prohibits entry in the U.S. from citizens from six countries still, Iran, Libya, Somalia, Sudan, Syria, and Yemen, for 90 days for those who do not already hold a valid visa, and that there will also be this delay for Syrian refugees for 90 days, 120 days.
120 days for all refugees.
For all refugees. Yeah. So, and they say it's going to be more difficult to kind of legally battle this for people who don't agree with it. So let me talk, turn to John and say, John, so explain exactly what you think this order does and why you think it's a more solid order, if in fact you do, and then we'll turn to Sabine.
Sure. Well, again, I don't particularly think that the first order was legally problematic, but certainly this new executive order attempts to address the two issues that were pointed out by the various courts that ruled on this, a district court judge in Seattle, one in Virginia, and, of course, the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals. So the two things that the court pointed out, said, well, the executive order as originally drafted was quite broad and would include not only people who were trying to come to our shore for the first time, but would arguably include green card holders and also people who were in the country already physically present, albeit unlawfully. The White House counsel, Don McGahn, had issued a clarification saying, no, the executive order wasn't meant to apply to green card holders or those people who were physically present unlawfully. But the court in the Ninth Circuit said, well, that's just a clarification from the White House counsel. That isn't what the executive order says. This new executive order clarifies that it does not apply to citizens, it doesn't apply to green card holders, it doesn't apply even to people who now have valid waivers as of the date of this executive order. It doesn't apply to people who are in the country unlawfully. So it clearly clears up that issue that had been identified by the Ninth Circuit. The other thing that the other court said, without actually making a factual finding, is that this could be perceived as, I don't want to use the phrase Muslim ban because it's a temporary suspension, but I'll use the phrase that critics use, which is a Muslim ban. I didn't believe that that was the case at the time. However, now the executive order goes into a lot more detail in terms of saying why these six particular countries have been included, which is unrelated to the fact that they are majority Muslim countries. Of course, they are only six out of 50 majority Muslim countries that are around the world. But nonetheless, it goes to great pains to identify why these six countries in particular were included in this temporary suspension.
Shireen.
Yes. So I will go ahead and use the phrase Muslim ban because I think that this order, just like the previous order, is actually a Muslim ban. You know, when you're looking at, and this is something that several of the courts were kind of looking at, and it was in the papers that were filed against the original order, which is that the intent to discriminate was clearly apparent from all of the statements that the administration and its friends had been making even before getting elected. And that discriminatory intent is still there. There is overwhelming evidence that the reason these travel orders were put into effect was to discriminate against Muslims and to ban Muslims from coming into the country. Otherwise, there's actually really no explanation for why the second order was even issued. I mean, the first order was clearly overbroad. It was overreaching. The second order cuts away at some of the substance, but it's still targeting people from countries where there's already, the Department of Homeland Security itself has said there's no evidence that targeting full countries actually helps with national security. It's also still kind of halting processing for the group of people who get the most extreme vetting. I mean, people use this phrase, extreme vetting. Refugees are vetted for years and years before they can come here. They get so much vetting that it's really hard to imagine what more vetting they could possibly get. It's just really hard to make heads or tails or any sense of the second order, except as being within the context of fulfilling a promise to have a Muslim ban.
Let's stop for a minute.
Can I respond to that briefly?
You can, but let me see if you can respond to it with this in mind, because this, could you both said something here that I want to explore in some depth, and
sure.
Let you jump right back in with this, John Malcolm. Which is, and I see David Rocha has just joined us, I'll introduce him in just a moment. It's the question of vetting. This has been at the heart of Donald Trump's argument since the campaign for president, and continues to be an argument that people are not vetted. And we've done shows in the past on vetting where we have people on the show arguing with this list of incredible things to be able to go through as vetting process. But the argument is that that's still not adequate. So let's talk for a moment about vetting, but do it in the context of what you just wanted to say, John. Go ahead.
Sure. As I said, these are six countries out of 50 majority Muslim countries. They constitute about 10% of the world's Muslim population. This isn't a ban. It's a temporary suspension. And the reason that these countries were identified is not because they are majority Muslim countries. If you were going to do that, you go to Saudi Arabia, Indonesia, places with far larger Muslim populations. These countries were singled out for particular reasons. One is three of them, Sudan, Syria, and Iran, had previously been designated as state sponsors of terrorism. This was by the Obama administration and by Congress. The other three, Libya, Somalia, and Yemen, had been previously identified by Obama's Department of Homeland Security Secretary Jay Johnson as being countries of concern. And the reason that they're countries of concern is that all six of these countries share one thing in common. They are either safe havens for terrorists, they are state sponsors of terrorists, or they are failing countries that do not, either don't cooperate with us or lack the capacity to do what you referred to as proper vetting. You know, you need to be able to have documentation, you need to be able to have proper records, you need to have adequate cooperation with us in information sharing. That is one of the reasons why Iraq, for instance, which apparently over the last month or so has stepped up its efforts to increase documentation and cooperation, and there's a large U.S. presence in the country, was taken off that list. Look, cyber criminals, for instance, will probe computer systems for weaknesses and vulnerabilities where they can enter those systems. Terrorists do the same kind of thing. Obviously, there are some forms of terrorism you just can't stop. No system is perfect. You can have lone wolf terrorists in this country for which this order will do absolutely nothing. But terrorism takes all forms, including people who are probing our system for weaknesses to come into this country, make contact with people who are already part of terrorist cells here. And as the executive order points out, there have been literally hundreds of people convicted already in this country for terrorism-related offenses, and there are over 300 active investigations involving refugees from some of these countries involving counterterrorism investigations. Go ahead.
And I just want to let Serene have a chance to jump in. I'm going to introduce David Rocha, who from the ACLU. David, welcome. Good to have you with us as well. Serene.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, 300 compared to what? Like, there are thousands and thousands of open investigations that involve U.S. citizens. There is not a single documented instance of a terrorist attack from one of the seven countries, or the six countries now, I guess. And the list of state sponsors of terrorism include many more countries than those three, but those other countries are not Muslim majority countries, and so they didn't make it onto the list. I think, you know, we can argue back and forth about this all day. If you look at the list of countries, it's the list of countries where it's politically feasible to actually have them on the list, and they are Muslim majority. There is not a single country on this list that is not Muslim majority, even though there are countries that are not Muslim majority where you could argue that the situation is equally chaotic and problematic. The vetting that refugees go through is actually so intense exactly because they are coming from difficult circumstances. But that's precisely what makes it so important that we welcome refugees here and not subject them to these kind of unnecessary and extraneous. I mean, I worked with Iraqi refugees a few years back, and they had to go through years of security screenings in some cases while they were waiting, their lives in danger, We've had people over the course of the past couple of weeks who are coming in because they were interpreters, for example, for the U.S. government in Afghanistan, in Iraq, in other places. And they were being subjected to additional scrutiny that really was completely unwarranted, even though they had gone through all the different security checks that they should have gone through from the beginning. So I find that this is not really what's going on in the background. And I actually also wanted to just point out that the people who are being affected by this ban are family members, U.S. citizens, lawful permanent residents who have been here for a very long time, who have family members abroad. Yes, this particular ban takes out lawful permanent residents, but it doesn't take out their family members. If I'm a lawful permanent resident here and I want to bring my spouse from somewhere else, that person is still going to be affected by the new ban. And I think that that's a very important point because it means that our values of family unity, our values of being a welcoming country, the fact that we're built on immigration, all of that is being cut to its core in a very symbolic way that targets only Muslim-majority countries for very specious reasons.
So let me ask this question. David Rucker, welcome to the conversation. I'm going to ask you this question and let John Malcolm come back right back in and respond. Let's talk for just a moment about the legal issues involved. And David, one of the things I've been reading in articles by people like Mark Berman from The Post and other places this morning, and people who are generally opposed to the ban, is that the way this new ban is being put into effect on these six countries and limiting the access from refugees is written in a way that will make it much more difficult for those who oppose this idea to battle it in court. Your thoughts on that, then I'll turn right to John for his response.
Well, the original ban was unconstitutional, and the new ban is unconstitutional for the reasons that Serene has, I think, clearly articulated. The original ban and this ban are clear attempts to make good on an unconstitutional promise that Donald Trump made as a candidate repeatedly to ban Muslims from coming into the United States. He can't do it as widely and as completely as he would like, so he's looking for ways to do it to the greatest extent possible. But that discriminatory animus was fatal to the original Muslim ban, and it's fatal to this one. In addition, there are statutory claims here, particularly related to the unconscionable ban on all refugees. The Refugee Act sets limits on the president's authority here, and Donald Trump has flagrantly violated those limits.
And how would you respond to that, John Malcolm?
Sure. Well, first of all, I think that Sarin said something that was factually inaccurate, which is I haven't parsed out the convictions from Iraq, but at least at the time of the original executive order with respect to the seven countries that applied, there had been 72 convictions of people from those countries for terrorism-related offenses. As to the animus that's involved, again, this is not a ban. It is a temporary suspension, and it only involves countries for 10% of the world's Muslim population. Yes, they will race into court, and they will find an intemperate tweet from Donald Trump and try to blow that up into the complete intent behind this executive order, but I think that is belied by the language of the executive order itself. Another thing that Sarin said was, oh, well, close family members will be affected. Under both the original executive order and even clearer under this executive order, it is clear that the Secretary of State and the Secretary for Homeland Security can have case-by-case waivers, and there are whole broad categories of people laying out for where case-by-case waivers might well be applicable, and close family relationships is certainly one of them. And with respect to the law, Congress has made it very, very clear in the Immigration and Nationality Act that the president is vested with broad authority to suspend the entry of any aliens into the United States when he believes it would be, quote, detrimental to the interests of the United States. And he has made those factual findings, and they are very clearly laid out country by country in this executive order. So I believe you never know what an activist judge is going to do. I fully expect that the people on this telephone call and other groups will file these sorts of actions, but I don't believe that those claims will be meritorious.
Shereen, do you want to say anything in response since you were called out there?
Since I was called out? Yes. I mean, I think that we can really, I said this before, I feel like we can go back and forth all day. There are numbers that are thrown around. The Center for Immigration Studies is the only one that has kind of put out this 72 figure. I haven't really seen it verified anywhere else. And in fact, in the course of the Washington litigation, the federal judge who is issuing the stay asked the government for examples that would support you know, like the countries that are listed, and the government was not able to come up with examples. The reasoning that is listed out in the new executive order could apply to, again, hundreds of countries around the world. They only chose the ones that are Muslim majority and the ones where it's politically feasible to kind of cut them out. And the point about family members, you know, I think it's simply, again, factually inaccurate to say that family members are not affected. This is actually exactly who we're talking with. And I'm here today also as a member of the Dallas Justice Coalition, which kind of is working on the airport and fielding questions from people who have been affected by these travel bans. And the vast majority of the questions we are getting are exactly from family members who are here in the United States, who are worried about visa processing for their immediate relatives outside of the United States and in these seven countries. And that's actually a fundamental matter of family unity. I am here because I immigrated to the United States. A lot of people are just like me. We are all equally American, and telling those people that they can't bring their family members here to kind of continue to build their lives here is fundamentally un-American and completely at odds with national security interests, as stated by the Department of Homeland Security's own internal report, which said very clearly that singling out countries does not actually help national security. There are people from all nationalities who commit crimes, but we're not banning Italians from this country for that reason.
I'm sorry, but that was a congressional report from which that data came about the number of convictions. And the executive order, which I have right in front of me, says case-by-case waivers could be appropriate in circumstances such as the following. And one of them is the foreign national seeks to enter the United States to visit or reside with a close family member, for example, a spouse.
Yeah, but these case-by-case waivers are not an answer. When you have to do a case-by-case waiver, what ends up happening is exactly the chaos that we saw at the airport on the 28th. The first executive order, let me remind you, you know, with all due respect, also had a case-by-case waiver exemption process. We really didn't see that being used very often. What you end up doing, no, because you have Customs and Border Protection who are given their marching orders, you have the airlines who are given their marching orders, and what ensues is chaos. And the people who are lucky enough to have like someone really influential on this side, or a congressperson or someone like that who's arguing for a case-by-case waiver, may be able to make use of that process, but we still haven't seen a procedure for how those case-by-case waivers are going to be adjudicated and how they're actually going to address the massive problem of the people who are being shut out who really should be able to come in.
I'm going to get back to David, but John, I'll let you respond, and I have a question for David that you can respond to as well. John, what were you about to say? I'm sorry.
Well, no, I was going to say that, you know, yes, the rollout for the initial executive order was very poor. Everybody, including Homeland Security Secretary, has said that. It was enjoined almost immediately. There are now, in fact, procedures in place. There is a frequently asked questions fact sheet that was put out along with the executive order, and it sets out how you can go about trying to get those waivers.
So one of the things, I have a question here from a listener by email, that how does this new ban affect undocumented people inside this country? David Rocha, these are separate issues, aren't they? But is this affected at all?
Yeah, well, it clarifies that the executive order, as was the case with the first executive order, it clarifies that it does not apply to people who are in this country already unlawfully. The Ninth Circuit pointed out, correctly so, that people who are physically present in this country unlawfully have some due process rights, not many, but they have some limited due process rights that were not provided for in the original executive order. So this executive order makes it clear that it does not apply to people who are physically present in this country but here unlawfully.
David Rocha?
I agree. That's true.
So there's another issue that was raised by some listeners here before we went on the air about this particular order. Let me kind of go through it real fast and let you kind of respond to this, which is going back to something we said earlier about where people come from who actually commit these acts and why they're not on the list. Somebody has made an argument, said that here, Mr. Malcolm made the argument about Iraq, but the reality is the reason we took Iraq off the list was because the Iraqi government was forcing the United States to take it off because of the war we have in Iraq. We need their cooperation. That was the bottom line. That's all it was about, not anything else. Is there an argument about that?
I mean, there were definitely news reports that DHS itself did not want Iraq to be on the list, and that very high-level national security officials thought that it would be really detrimental to the security of the United States to have Iraq especially on the list. I mean, there have generally been arguments from national security experts across the board that having particular countries, any of those countries, on a list actually is detrimental to national security, but with Iraq in particular because of the special situation and the need for their cooperation with American efforts there. That's, I guess, according to the
John, what are we going to say?
Well, that may be part of it, but that is by no means the only reason that was done. And again, I'm quoting from the executive order itself. It says, the close cooperative relationship between the United States and the democratically elected Iraqi government, the strong United States diplomatic presence in Iraq, the significant presence of United States forces in Iraq, and Iraq's commitment to combat ISIS justify different treatment. And
I mean, all this was true a month ago.
I'm sorry, I'm not quite done.
Sorry.
One other thing in particular, it says that since the original executive order was issued, the Iraq government has expressly undertaken steps to enhance travel documentation, information sharing, and the return of Iraqi nationals subject to final orders of removal. So they have already taken steps to improve their cooperation with us and vetting.
Now, what were you about to say? David Rocha, why don't you leap in on this so we have a kind of a balance here. David?
Well, as Serene accurately was about to point out, everything that was said about Iraq was true when the original order was signed. I mean, look, in the end, the evidence of intent is crystal clear for anyone who is willing to have their eyes open and their ears open. And all this post hoc attempt at obfuscation and rationalization is nonsense. So, you know, he can spout it from now until the cows come home, but it doesn't change the basic operative facts on the ground.
What does that mean? Doesn't change the operative facts on the ground?
That Donald Trump has made it crystal clear precisely what he is doing. It could not possibly be clearer. The evidence is there for all to see. He has been, I mean, one can say many things about Donald Trump, but that he has hidden his intent is not one of them.
They, and my rejoinder to that would be your two other guests can both say, well, we all know what's going on here. This is nothing more than a Muslim ban. Look at the tweet that he sent out at 3:30 in the morning. That's not what this executive order says. It lays out country by country why these six countries were selected. And I would point out that these were countries that were designated as failing countries, safe havens for terrorists, or state sponsors of terrorism.
All of which is why...
And the Obama administration.
Right. All of which is why persons coming from those countries are already subject to heightened scrutiny. None of it,
exactly.
As this administration's own Department of Homeland Security, as Serene has pointed out, said, justifies what we are doing here.
I mean, this president pointed out that if you are a safe haven for terrorism, a state sponsor of terrorism, or a failing country that doesn't cooperate with us, that's not good enough, and we need to have not a ban, but a temporary suspension to shore up that vulnerability.
So let's go.
Which is also, I mean, if this was such a, I mean, here's the way in which you see the nonsense piled upon nonsense. If this was so urgent, then why did Donald Trump delay it in order to try to maximize the good press that he got for being able to read from a teleprompter in front of Congress? I mean, these arguments are so patently absurd.
That you can say that in court. I don't believe that.
Well,
well, I mean, but this is the president of the United States. No, I mean, I'm sorry. I actually find it really curious that people are now saying, well, the president of the United States doesn't actually speak for the policy of the United States. Like, that's essentially what, you know, Mr. John's statements amount to. If the president sends out a tweet, that is the president of the United States who is saying exactly why he is pursuing the policies he is pursuing. And we should take that with the utmost seriousness, even if he's doing it through Twitter and not through the ordinary or usual channels. I mean, this is the president of the United States. He speaks for his own policy.
You are certainly going to try to make hay of that, and you can, and that is your right. He has spoken through this executive order and all of the justifications laid out in the executive order, including the delegated authority that Congress has given him and all of the reasons why he has identified these six countries as posing a heightened risk of terrorism, and that admitting refugees and people without visas who are seeking entry at this particular time without this temporary pause would be detrimental to the interests of the United States.
And he has spoken through Twitter.
And let's talk a bit about what the having the number of refugees that will come to the United States in wake of the order, that which all the papers and news outlets have kind of covered as well, which is that the number of refugees allowed in the United States will be cut in half.
By more than half.
Well, so I thought last year we admitted about 87,000 refugees, and this is capped at 50, so that's less than half. But
no,
I could be wrong about that, but I don't think
the president had approved 110,000 refugees, and the new limit is 50,000.
Last year, we admitted 87,000.
Yeah, every year, the admission is slightly less than the cap, and the cap actually kind of indicates, like, the target that they are shooting for, and pretty much every year, it's a little bit below that target. So if the target is 50, you can expect it to be below that target also.
Well,
but the target is less than half.
Last year, we admitted 87,000. The cap here is 50, so that is less than half.
Well, the cap last year was 110, and the cap this year is 50, so that would be less than half. You have to compare apples to apples, in my opinion.
Okay. Last year we admitted 87,000 people. If we admit 50,000, that will be roughly a 1/3 cut.
This is true.
So the administration's arguments is that it will protect refugees by creating safe zones in Syria. Nobody here is a foreign policy expert, I take, but this is not your complete bailiwick. But that's an interesting thing to me when I read that, John Malcolm, just because. Having covered the Iraq War and what's happening in Syria with some intensity over the last 17, 18 years since 9/11, that we've had a very difficult time creating safe zones anywhere. And I wasn't quite sure what this really meant, whether it comes from President Obama talking about safe zones or Donald Trump talking about safe zones. We can't create safe zones. What does that mean?
Well, you know, here your guests had the drop on me, I suppose, and that I am not an expert.
I said none of the three of you are. So go ahead,
I recognize that some of these countries are active combat zones, and so that this might be a very, very difficult thing to do. I'm not meaning in any way, shape, or form to understate the plight of refugees, nor am I meaning to understate the difficulty of establishing safe zones in that country. But the president is, of course, tasked with his most important task, which is protecting our homeland and doing what is necessary to keep us safe here. But I'm not meaning to, to in any way, shape, or form denigrate many refugees who face very, very desperate circumstances or the difficulty of the task of establishing safe zones overseas.
So I'm going to come back to something I alluded to earlier and kind of get to the issue of why this is that some people are arguing that this new order makes it more difficult to combat in court, because it exempts legal permanent residents and people who already have been issued visas. Iraq is no longer on the order. And instead of being an indefinite ban, citizens of Syria are now banned for 90 days, like those of the other five nations. And so that's why it makes this much more difficult to fight in court, because you originally, I guess, David Rocha, the original battle around this also had to do with Rudy Giuliani's being part, and that was one of the arguments being made, being part of the writing of the ban, where he was very clear this was a ban on Muslims, and we're trying to figure out a way to do it so that it would be palpable
palatable.
Thank you. Couldn't get that word out of my head for some reason. Thank you very much. Appreciate that. If my father was watching from up there, wherever he is right now, he'd be yelling at me about my grammar. But I'm
happy to help.
So it makes it much more difficult to kind of argue against at this moment, because that's no longer part of the equation. David, and then we'll go to John.
Well, I disagree. It's true that they've tinkered around the edges to remove some of the most flagrantly offensive and illegal aspects of the original order. But as I said earlier, the fundamental problem remains, which is that this is an executive order devoid of a actual security rationale that is intended solely to make good on what was, has always been, and will always be an unconstitutional campaign promise by Donald Trump to ban Muslims from coming to the United States. He has stated his desire to do that repeatedly, not just in 3 a.m. tweets, but in formal speeches. Nothing that he does with respect to this order can change that fundamental fact, particularly given the utter lack of a coherent, rational security rationale for this order, which I think Serene has explained incredibly well.
And John?
Look, there's a perfectly coherent and rational security justification for singling out these six countries for a temporary suspension of entry into this country, and it's laid out in the executive order. And you have heard what their argument in court is going to be, which is, we all know what this really is. Pay no attention, you know, to the man behind the curtain. You know, we know in his heart that he hates Muslims, and this is a Muslim ban. And even if this was only one country, Yemen, which has no, just failing by any, a failing government by any definition, we would still know that what is in his heart is a Muslim ban, and this is motivated by animus and unconstitutional. I think that that is wrong. I thought it was wrong with respect to the initial order. I certainly think it's wrong with respect to this order, which lays out the factual basis for why these six countries were selected, and they were identified by the Obama administration, not by the Trump administration. But we'll see how their argument flies in court.
Now, can I actually jump in just on this point really quickly? So first of all, it's not in his heart, it's in his words. Second of all, the reason the Refugee Convention exists and the reason under international law that countries do take in refugees, as does the United States of America, is exactly because there are failing states. And so repeating that some of these countries are failing states is actually not, you know, it doesn't really move the conversation forward. I just want to also point out what this temporary suspension means is, for example, if you've just gone through a three-year process to get your security clearance, that security clearance expires. So if you're a refugee, it's not like you get your security clearance and you're done. It's good for a certain amount of time. These 120 days are going to cause a lot of people who have already been suffering and in danger for their lives and waiting to come in to actually have to go back and start the process from scratch again for years and years. So like we shouldn't really understate, even though it just talks about temporary suspension, we should not understate the effect that it's having. And also just on a community level, the Muslim community itself here in this country is feeling targeted. If you look, the New York Times yesterday ran an op-ed by Muslim advocates, and they were saying, look, we speak for our community, and this is a Muslim ban, and this is targeting us. And I actually really think that this is something that should be lifted up and, you know, focused on, that this community is feeling that it's targeted. This is not coming from nowhere. It's coming both from the way that the travel bans have been issued, from all the words that Donald Trump has said, and from the actions on the ground. We have people who are afraid to let their high school children go on exchange programs. This is something that every high school student in the U.S. who is lucky enough to do so should be able to do so. If you're a Muslim in this country right now, you are afraid to travel. You are afraid to let your children travel. It doesn't really matter what the words on the paper are because the intent has been so overwhelming and so clearly stated. So I just want to move us away from talking about what's in people's hearts to talking about what our president is actually saying and what the effect of these quote-unquote temporary suspensions is actually going to be.
So this also, though, makes it for the, and we only have a few minutes left, so I want to very quick comment and bring John back in here as well, but this also makes it very difficult, it seems to me, for people who did things like the protests that you helped run at the airports out of D.C., because it won't be taking place in the United States anymore. This is happening from the source countries themselves. And so it strategically also makes it changes the parameters of this debate.
I think it remains to be seen how it's going to be implemented. I don't actually believe that it's 100% going to all take place at the airports. I mean, at the airports abroad. There's been a lot of movement in airports abroad to kind of help people who are stranded there and trying to get on flights and et cetera. But there's this very kind of unclear issue about people who get visas after March 16, people who get visas before March 16. If you do get a visa after March 16, does that mean that you can enter? The airlines are going to be confused. I think, you know, the way that the first order was implemented is going to be a pretty good indication of how the second order is going to be implemented. It's not like this travel ban is crystal clear about how the implementation is going to happen. So I think that there's still going to be a lot of confusion. I think people are going to come with valid admission docs and be getting turned away by airlines because Customs and Border Protection, just like last time, is not giving them correct instructions or accurate instructions. So, you know, we're still on the ground at Dulles. I know that a lot of airports around the country are still kind of mobilizing and have some people on the front lines to help troubleshoot issues that family members face. But I would not say that this is like a, you know, it's all done and it's none of it is going to happen in the United States.
And John, before we have to run, do you want to have a closing thought here as well?
Yeah, I mean, again, there is an act that covers refugees. But there is also an act that delegates to the president the authority to suspend the entry of any alien into the U.S. when he believes that it would be detrimental to the interests of the United States. I certainly have worked with and have a number of friends who are Muslim, who are United States citizens, who are good, decent, honorable people who love this country and would defend this country and have fought and died for this country. And I am sorry if a number of them are feeling vulnerable and attacked. I suppose I can't blame them for that. I think we all need to take a deep breath here and see how this all takes place.
And Ibaruka, what will be your position here legally? Where do you take this?
I think the ACLU has made it quite clear that we thought the original ban was unconstitutional and illegal. We think the second ban is unconstitutional, illegal, and we're committed to challenging this president's illegal actions.
So we will continue covering this, I mean, and seeing where this takes us. First, let me thank everybody who is here today. John Malcolm is director of the Edwin Meese III Center for Legal and Judicial Studies and the Ed Gilbertson and Sherry Lindbergh Gilbertson Senior Legal Fellow at the Heritage Foundation. John, thank you so much for being part of this program today.
It was a pleasure being with all of you.
And Shireen Shabaya is with us in the House. She is a civil rights attorney, one of the organizers of the Dulles Justice Coalition, created in response to the recent travel bans, and former director of the ACLU of Maryland's Immigrants' Rights Program. Always good to have you in the studio, Shireen. Thank you so much for coming in.
Great to be here. Thank you.
David Rocha is the senior staff attorney at the ACLU here in Maryland. David, always good to talk to you as well.
Thank you so much, Mark.
Thank you all. And we'll continue looking at this with some intensity. This is just the first blush as we look at this new executive order. And I take a short break, but I want you to stay with us, reminding you the Mark Steiner Show is brought to you in part by the Maryland State Education Association. From limiting overtesting to protecting public school funding, you can learn more about the issues facing Maryland students, parents, and schools by visiting the Maryland State Education Association website at MarylandEducators.org. That's MarylandEducators.org. We'll be right back. Don't go away. We can take a look at homelessness in the city, the removal of an encampment. What comes next? Don't go away.